fans. You're listening to Radio Regent. This is Saturday Morning Live. We're heard here every Saturday, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. You were listening to a special day today because you got a full hour of the Horn Report. One was with Norman Otis Richmond on Diasporic Music, which was recorded last Sunday. His show can be heard every Sunday from 2 to 4. And if you're on the West Coast, it's 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And you were listening also, right after that was interview recorded at CHRY with Ome yesterday. So anyway, so we're going to go to the Horn Report, and that will take us to the end of the show. I mean, the Black Agenda Report. And that will take us to the end of the show, and we'll see everybody else. We'll see you next week in the whirlwind, and hopefully you'll have a good week. And this is the Black Agenda Report.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Republicans and Democrats find something they can agree on: gut the social safety net. Poor children don't even get lip service in the public schools. And what do Martin Luther King Jr. and Barack Obama have in common? Not much of anything.
But first, President Obama's gun control proposals include allowing the use of federal funds to increase the police presence in local schools. But armed police officers are already a fixture of many Black and brown inner city school systems, while most of the mass killings have occurred in white suburban school settings. We spoke with Matthew Krieger of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund.
There's a damaging trend in this country that in 1999, there was a tragic school shooting in Littleton, Colorado at Columbine High School. And we witnessed thereafter a proliferation of zero tolerance policies in our schools and increased presence of police officers in our schools. And this was done with the intent to improve school safety. And it was done immediately by well-intentioned legislators who wanted to protect children. The danger is that we know a lot more now than we did in 1999. And what you said is right. When we look at who is policed, whose schools are policed, and which students have to go through metal detectors, get pat-downs, get drug searched on a routine basis, it's our students of color and our communities of color across this country. In places like Columbine, thankfully, we've recognized the need for things like counseling to deal with tragedies. That's not how we treat our students of color and students in low-income communities in this country.
Yes, for example, the schools in Newark, which are heavily policed, actually resemble prison institutions.
We've heard reports from folks in New York City, and New York, incidentally, has 5,000 school safety agents who are sworn officers patrolling New York City schools. If this were measured against the actual police forces of other localities in this country, it would be the nation's fifth largest police force, bigger than Boston's, bigger than DC's, bigger than Las Vegas's, for example. And students routinely stand outside their school, doesn't matter what time of year, for half an hour, an hour, or more, trying to get in through school security lines. Advancement Project and Youth United for Change issued a damning report on police treatment of students in Philadelphia, a district that has recently revised its discipline code in part as a result, telling stories of girls who, in the midst of pat-downs, were asked to remove their bras and be checked not for weapons but for cell phones. This is not the way that we educate our children. This is not the way we create a learning environment where students feel nurtured, loved, and given the opportunity to both grow and learn.
You note in your press release that 42% of students who are referred to law enforcement and 35% of students arrested are African Americans nationwide.
That's right. And these are just preliminary findings from the U.S. Department of Education as they've begun to look more deeply at these issues. The Department of Education and the Department of Justice have launched a supportive school discipline initiative to get at this school-to-prison pipeline, and it is imperative that in whatever the administration does in response to this terrible, gut-wrenching tragedy that has left us reeling as a nation, that we learn from these lessons and see what happens. We know that the first time a student is arrested, it doubles their odds for dropping out of school. The first time they have a court appearance quadruples those odds. If we're serious about ending this so-called dropout crisis and closing this so-called achievement gap, we can't begin to do that until we really wrestle with these policies that are pushing our students, particularly African-American students, students of color, out of our schools.
It would seem that the schools-to-prison pipeline would only be reinforced by bringing in armed police.
At this point, we know that approximately 70% of students ages 12 to 15 already see some regular police presence at their schools, okay? And it's confounding to us where these police are going to go. And I say that at a time when, in Chicago, for example, there is a teacher shortage. There is a dramatic shortage of placement of school counselors, of mental health workers, of folks that can help support our students. Instead, you have approximately two police officers themselves stationed at every high school in Chicago. And we have to think about how we're investing in our youth when we place these funds. You know, it's not just us. It's conservative think tanks like the Texas Public Policy Foundation who are saying we are bankrupting our state budgets by sending kids from school to juvenile court for things that we used to handle with a call home.
And what you'd like to see, what you've recommended, is that instead of police, we see more psychologists and counselors and social workers in the schools.
And it's not just us, right? The FBI, the Secret Service in response to Columbine, and even aspects of the president's proposal point to how key it is that schools maintain significant connectedness and communication between students and teachers. Without that, there is no real channel for students to convey their concerns, their worries, and their fears, whether they're about interactions, bullying and harassment, discrimination, or school safety. And we know that the best means to prevent violence targeted at schools is through improving that communication and connectedness. And there are a number of ways to do that. Restorative justice programs, positive behavior support programs, social emotional learning programs, a number of which already have the support of some congressional leaders like Bobby Scott and Tom Harkin, and the support of the administration as well. If we are going to create a culture in our schools where our students feel safe and protected, we have to lean on these strategies. The research shows us that when we involve police in school discipline, it can breed an atmosphere of alienation and distrust and actually make the school environment more disorderly. I wish I could say that we can clearly draw the lines between what is a safety matter to be handled by police and what is a discipline matter to be handled by schools. But sadly, placing school resource officers in our schools has only served to blur that line, and it's routine to hear stories like that of 12-year-old Alexa Gonzalez, who was arrested at her Queens, New York middle school just over a year ago for writing on her desk, "I love my friends," in erasable marker.
That was Matthew Krieger of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund.
The nation's social safety net faces its greatest threat in modern American history, with Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid all in the line of fire. Activist Eric Dreitzer says there's a consensus among both major political parties that social programs must be gutted.
There's a number of reasons. I think at a basic level, austerity is essentially the shifting of the burden of the depression from those who created it to those who must pay for it. And specifically, we're talking about Wall Street, the City of London, the financiers and the speculators shifting that burden of a crisis that they created onto the working class and the poor. And the way in which they shift that burden is by gouging the social safety net, those programs which many working class and poor people depend on for their very survival. This is a concerted attack by financiers and the ruling class against the legacy of the New Deal, against the legacy of economic rights that workers and poor people have struggled for generations. And it is using an economic depression in order to actually remake the economy. What we're seeing in the United States and also in Europe as well is a conversion of the economy from a traditionally high wage economy where those who wanted work could find work and find it at a decent living wage to a low wage economy, one in which you are essentially a servant to multinational corporations working for the lowest possible wage at the maximum number of hours and with no rights as a worker, no rights as a human being. And that at a basic level is what austerity is, and using this crisis to backdoor the attack on these programs, which up until very recently would have been unthinkable.
And so the drive is not just, of course, to save money, but to eliminate these social safety net programs to create more insecurity and fear among the workforce so that they will work for any wage that is offered.
That's absolutely correct, and it is to roll back the gains made by the workers' movements, by organized labor, and so forth. It is to attack the very foundation of those institutions which have been used to attack the power of finance capital over the course of a number of decades. The crisis itself, which it's always important to remember, was created by the Wall Street ruling class. This crisis is now the pretext that that same ruling class uses to attack the legacy of those programs. And the austerity drive, I think we should also remember, is something more than just gouging the social safety net. It is union busting at a very basic level. We see this across the board. All you need to do is look at the teachers, the situation of charter schools, to look at the way that Obama was complicit in busting the UAW in Michigan and elsewhere, to look at the way that the Republicans and their Democratic co-conspirators have been able to push through so-called right-to-work laws around the country. All of these gains from the perspective of reactionaries, all of these gains are part of an austerity drive to essentially drive the economy back into a pre-1930s state, one in which the financiers and speculators are free to continue their wanton criminality while the rest of the working class and the poor are the teeming masses at the bottom, essentially creating a neo-feudal or a capitalist utopia.
The Democrats created the New Deal. Democrats also created the Great Society programs, which included Medicare. But this Democratic Party seems to be in league with the Republicans in its austerity.
That's right, and I think nowhere is this better illustrated than the so-called grand bargain. Obama, I suppose to his evil credit, never even made a pretense about trying to represent that legacy of the Democratic Party and Democratic traditions. Rather, he came in with the mentality that he would attack those same programs and that he was much more interested in so-called reaching across the aisle to work with his so-called partners in the Republican Party. Never even once pretending that he was going to represent poor people, working people, African Americans, or any other group that is traditionally part of the Democratic Party and that is very much a fundamental part of Obama's base. So when we look at the fact that Obama is, to any logical extent, a co-conspirator and collaborator of these austerity themes, then what we see is that there is what I call an austerity consensus in Washington. This is the consensus consensus of the ruling class of Wall Street, and Obama is their dutiful servant and their humble representative to the people. What Obama is able to do that no one before him has ever been able to do is to sell austerity to the left, just as he's able to sell war and militarism to the left. What we saw with the invasion and the imperialist aggression against Libya and the way he was able to sell that to the left in the United States is the same thing we see with the way that he sells austerity, and that is with left cover, with the veneer of progressivism as he attacks the very foundations that make up what we understand to be traditional progressive values.
And he has sold it to the most historically progressive constituency in the country, the African American community.
Yes, indeed. And what he's able to do is show such a level of arrogance because he understands that to the vast majority of the African American community, he is essentially untouchable. He does not have to tangibly represent values for that community. He doesn't have to provide any tangible gains or anything substantive. All he needs to be is a dark-skinned face in a high position of power, and therein lies his value to that community. He understands this, which is why he has never even pretended to make any concessions to the Black Caucus and the Congress, to make any real attempt to appeal to Black America in any real way. And so what he has been able to do, aside from all of these other achievements of his, is to transform what, as you mentioned, the traditionally most progressive segment of the population, transform it into cheerleaders for reactionary militarist values, which up until very recently would have been unthinkable. All of those social ills that are at the core of the concerns of Black America are not on the agenda for Obama. There is no mention of mass incarceration, of the new Jim Crow. There is no mention, really, of anything substantive other than to say that Blacks need to quiet down and to know their place and to make sure that they represent what Obama tells them to represent.
How does one pull together a real anti-austerity coalition? You pulled off one very successful meeting in New York late last year.
Well, to pull together an anti-austerity coalition, the most important thing is to understand that you have to have a program. You have to be making demands, not just of the president, but of the American people themselves. You have to first destroy the mythology that exists, that is sold by the mainstream media, the mythology that deficits and debts are the most pressing problems in America. Instead, an anti-austerity movement has to stand up for what undeniably are the economic rights, and I say that again, the economic rights of the American people. That is the right to health care, the right to public education, the right to a home, the right to a job. And the way that you stand up for these things is by providing the solutions that are necessary to bring them about. So when we're talking about this, we're talking about arresting the bankers, taxing Wall Street, attacking the Federal Reserve, underscoring the fact that you have to delegitimize those institutions which create this monopoly of power that Wall Street and the ruling class maintains. And an anti-austerity movement will be able to answer those pressing issues while at the same time not ignoring the fact that at the fundamental level, our economic problems are very much tied in with our social and political ones. So an anti-austerity movement does not purely focus on the white working class in America. We also need to incorporate the ethnic minorities, the racial minorities, and all of the social problems that are connected with that, and to make the connection to U.S. imperialism, to recognize that the struggle of the American working class and poor is the same struggle of the people of Libya, it is the same struggle of the people of Mali, and all over the world where U.S. imperialism runs wild, that U.S. imperial system is directly connected to the Wall Street ruling class, and when you attack one, you attack both, and you delegitimize that drive to the U.S. empire.
Bankers are probably the most hated group of people in this country, so why is it so difficult to organize a movement against them?
Because the Wall Street bankers, the speculators, what they're able to do is to operate above the law, to operate in the shadows. So when we look at the mainstream corporate media, what we see is a variety of characters who are shown to be in control, who really have no control, who take their cues from people whose names you don't know, whose faces you never see. So when we talk about an institution like the Federal Reserve or the Treasury Department, we see faces like Timothy Geithner, but very rarely do we talk about Jamie Dimon or any of the other individuals, Lloyd Blankfein at Goldman Sachs, and the people who go into the White House regularly and who are talking into the ear of Obama and the elected officials. So to organize against the bankers, to organize against the criminals, it is to organize against a force that the vast majority of Americans are simply not familiar with. It is, at its very basic level, an abstraction for people. When you bring it down into a concrete reality and you show people that the actual criminality that they're fighting against is one that they can see, it's one that they live through and live under, that's when you can begin to organize people. And when you have this consensus among the American people, understanding where the crimes are being committed, only then can you be able to address any of these problems.
Eric Dratzer produces the website StopImperialism.com.
Among some black preachers and politicians, it's an article of faith that the Obama presidency is somehow the historical fulfillment of the movement led by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. So what do President Obama and Martin Luther King have in common? Not much, according to Omali Yesintela, veteran political activist and chairman of the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace and Reparations.
Yeah, there does seem to be that notion that's being put forward a lot to the detriment of any real understanding of the significance of Dr. Martin Luther King as a historical force in this country and in the world and what he really stood for in the movement. I lived and participated in the struggle of African people in the United States during the time that King was a really important figure. I was not a follower of King, and in many ways, in many instances, we were critics of King. When I say we, I mean people who came from my political persuasion, some of whom were associated with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and other similar kinds of organizations. Having said that, though, no one could underestimate the significance of Martin Luther King as an historical figure, nor the significance of the politic that he put forth. And unlike people who have used his name subsequent to his assassination to promote an agenda that puts them in bed with imperialism, the empire, with the United States government, King, while never disassociating himself with the concept of America, always was a critic of American foreign policy and what America was doing inside the United States, too. And it is my conviction that it was his stance on all of these questions that led to his assassination, and I am convinced by the United States government itself.
Dr. King broke with the Johnson administration, which had been seen by some as acting in some ways as an ally of Dr. King's wing of the movement. And would it not be logical that if King were alive today, he would break with this, the first black president, over his war policies?
There's no doubt that King would be opposed to the policies of Barack Hussein Obama. He opposed Vietnam, and some believe that it was his stance around Vietnam in particular that resulted in his assassination. I think it probably was associated with the stance around Vietnam, but also I think it was his departure from what the FBI characterized as his fidelity to philosophical nonviolence, etc. But King characterized the United States government as the greatest purveyor of violence on earth. And he broke the really famous presentation he made at Riverside Church in New York a year before his assassination, where he publicly said that given what the U.S. was doing in Vietnam, he was having greater difficulty in convincing African people that they should maintain a stance of nonviolence. He opposed what the United States government was doing in Vietnam. He opposed what the United States government also, and I think this is really important to say, certainly sectors of the government was doing to black people in the United States itself. We can't forget that the United States government represented itself in the form of the Bull Connors and the other sheriffs and law officials that constantly attack black people in the struggle for civil rights. And while King thought, for at least for a while, that the federal government was an ally in the struggle for civil rights, it was clear most of the time that it was these local organizations, not just in the South, but also, I say organizations, I mean governments, but also in the North, that were opposed to the advances of black people in this country. And I mentioned that just in case there are people who would be confused to believe that King would have only been opposed to what Barack Hussein Obama's government is doing with his war policies, his foreign policy objectives, but he would also be opposed to the killings of Africans around this country by law enforcement organizations and white people who are associated with the law enforcement organizations. He would be opposed to the domestic economic policies, the so-called austerities and things like that. In fact, some people also believe that it was King's mobilization, the March of the Poor, that he had begun before being killed that resulted in his assassination. And then we know that it was in Memphis, Tennessee, where he had gone to support black sanitation workers where he was killed. So in every instance, what we see is a Martin Luther King that was willing to struggle against the policies of the United States, domestic and foreign, and at the point where they seem to be going against the interests of the people, not only people in this country, but people around the world. That was Martin Luther King. And these attempts to show some kind of straight line between the efforts of King and the existence of Barack Hussein Obama and his presidency and politics clearly out of sync. And the reality is that the only reason they could say that today is because of the success of the forces that killed King in erasing from the memory of so many people who followed him, the generation subsequent to that, of what the struggle of black people in this country was all about. And I think that, again, Barack Obama's ascension to the presidency came as a consequence in part of the assassination of King and others like him who really stood for progress for black people and for other oppressed people around the world.
Yes, that is the school of thought that says that if Malcolm had not died, if King had not been taken out, and in a larger sense, if COINTELPRO and other federal and state and local programs had not wiped out or incarcerated a whole generation of activists, we would have a very different black community that would not tolerate the Barack Obamas of politics.
We would have an extraordinarily different black community, and the problem here, of course, is that this is not even new. I mean, we've seen this kind of phenomenon throughout the world where the oppressor will actually eliminate genuine forces who are struggling for freedom and then replace those forces with someone who might look like them and offer them up as substitutes that, depending on the memory of the community, people are more or less inclined to accept. I think that the African community has paid a deep price in our struggle, too deep a price, too big a price to find it acceptable that this man, Barack Hussein Obama, who has extended the war machine of the United States government beyond anything in recent memory, and I think I've read someplace where he was characterized as the most militaristic president of the United States in the last 10 years or more. So I think that Obama and King, the only connection they would have in the real world is that King would be leading the demonstrations today against the Obama regime if he were alive, not only, again, for his foreign policy, but also because of what his government is doing inside this country in the form of the Holders, the Eric Holders of the Justice Department, in the form of the so-called austerity programs that ripping the heart out of black and poor communities throughout this country. King would be an opponent of Obama. About that, there should be no uncertainty. And I think that, of course, Obama is not the only one who has used this thing about King. Some people who were closely associated with King have made a lot of money and prestige for themselves doing things that King never would have done. And I use in particular someone like Jesse Jackson, who actually was Clinton's man in Africa for that administration that was pursuing, you know, very vicious policies in Africa. Someone like this man who was never associated with King. In fact, he was associated with a fellow you know quite well, Glenn Ford, James Brown, who is participating as like the front man for Barack Hussein Obama's policies of war and policies of aggression against the rights of the people in this country.
You're talking about Al Sharpton, of course.
I'm talking about Al Sharpton.
And Don King as well.
Yeah, and so there were a lot of people who actually benefited from a real or vicarious association with Martin Luther King, who parlayed that association into fame and notoriety and sometimes money for themselves in a way that King never would have done. And we know he never would have done it because he never did do it when he was alive and obviously had an opportunity to do that should he have desired, and to have done it much better than the people who followed him.
And, of course, you, as chairman of the Black is Back Coalition, have led a number of demonstrations against the Obama administration, demonstrations straight to the gates of the White House. As Obama begins his second term, do you see cracks in what used to be his near-unanimous black support?
I definitely see cracks. I think that the contradiction that we are most confronted with now is not the one that we were confronted with in the past, where people in our community ran out to support Obama, assuming that he was going to really bring about changes for us. I think the contradiction that we're looking at today is that many black people feel that they have no other alternative and that the electoral arena is the only legitimate arena where struggle can occur. So for many people, it's a question of, if I don't vote for Obama, then I got to vote for this white guy who clearly in one way or another shows some kind of opposition to the interests of black people. So at least Obama is black while he's doing these horrible things in the world. But what I continue to see, not just as an individual who lives in the black community, but someone who's really struggling all the time to try and bring our folk into political life, is that it is increasingly, first of all, that the majority, that black people went to the polls to vote for Obama this time around with a lot less enthusiasm than before, that it took a lot of hard work to get people out. And then secondly, that you don't find the kind of knee-jerk reaction to criticism, legitimate criticism of Obama, coming from this community that we used to find before. A problem is that when that criticism has come from white people, then it gives the appearance of a racist attack against the black community, who many see as being represented by Barack Hussein Obama, and there's a circling of the wagon kind of mentality that can go into effect. But when we do political work out in the world to try to involve our community and taking on these issues, and we criticize, and we do criticize Obama severely, you know, not subjectively, but just laying out what his policies are, what they've meant, and the reality is that if there's going to be a black president, then damn it, he ought to be able to do something for black people and look at what's happening with us. And we get no arguments from anyone in the community around that.
We saw late last year that the National Action Network, Sharpton's group, the NAACP, the National Urban League, and a bunch of other
similar
organizations came together to put together what seemed like the beginnings of an effort to formulate a set of demands. What came out of that meeting didn't look very much like a set of demands, though, did it?
It didn't, and I think that, unfortunately, it's become a rather a tradition of sorts in this country to set up these straw horses and debate, you know, arguments, neither of which hold any kind of real significance in the world. But no, there are no demands being made, and this is, by the way, it seems to me, like one of the means by which these groups of Negroes offering up an apology for Obama with the statement in action that Obama can't do it by himself, and of course, if Obama's going to do anything, it's going to be based on demands coming from our communities. And so you come up with this charade that's called creating demands, and it legitimizes Obama's not doing anything at all, and notwithstanding the insignificance of what these groups are coming up with, it offers an assumption that this is the stimuli that's supposed to make Obama move in one direction or another, without which Obama should not be expected to do anything, could not do anything, something they've never said about any other sitting president. None of them has ever said this about any other sitting president, that these guys can't do anything and shouldn't do anything unless you make some kind of special demands on them.
In fact, their wish lists look like they were compiled from talking points from the White House.
Yes, and probably were coming from talking points. I mean, the reality that we are looking at, quite frankly, is that most of what has posed over the last several years as leadership of our community has absolutely turned its agenda over to the White House. And all of them are not simply the traditional liberal kind of black politic. I mean, a whole assortment of groups and personalities have now prostrated themselves before American imperialism simply because it now appears in a blackface, and because I imagine there is a gain, an ability to get themselves on guest lists at particular events that might be happening at the White House or sponsored by this government. And I imagine that's heady stuff for people who, as Malcolm X used to say, would be satisfied just with being invited to tea by the White House. This must be heady stuff, being able to meet with, and I'm sure it happens with some frequency, with representatives from the Obama regime, and again, being on the invitation list for specific kinds of functions that help to consolidate Obama's reputation in some circles and to consolidate their reputation as being somebody with insider connections.
But the Black is Back coalition, to the contrary, is attempting to set up a pole of opposition to this administration and its policies, domestic and international. What's up for the Black is Back coalition in 2013?
Not only to set up a pole of opposition, but also because we are quite aware that Obama's electoral success will be an impetus for many black people to enter into political life primarily through the electoral process, as compared to a couple of generations ago when people saw political life as being involved in mass movements. The Black is Back Coalition has on the top of its agenda for 2013 in July a national conference to actually try and help to define what is progressive electoral politics. How should we be engaged in it? How to be successful in it? In other words, we want to try and ride this motion, but give it better definition, and if lack of a better term, to try and create a movement in this country that would take for Keynesian politics into the electoral arena. The same kind of politics that should inform any of our communities. What should be policies that mayors, black people running for local government, what kind of policies should we be pursuing? What kind of policies should people who are running for the Congress and running for state government be pursuing for it to be considered legitimate, as opposed to the kind of politic that's represented by an Obama or some of the others that we've seen in Jersey and Philadelphia and places like that, and not to be limited to those places, but what Obama has done is set such a low bar in terms of what our expectations should be in politics, that it's absolutely necessary for us to challenge that and to say that electoral politics, if it's to be meaningful at all, has to advance the historically established interests and aspirations of black people, not just, as I've heard some black politicians and sometimes people who elected into office, not just as I've heard some say that to get the potholes fixed, but I think black people want more than potholes fixed. I think black people want security, and security from police, security in our own communities. Black people want to be able to have incomes and not just the ability to be the most recent fired at Walmart or McDonald's. People want to be able to aspire for a genuine future and secure from police terror, secure from the massive incarceration, the disappearances that occur in our communities every day, where it's almost a rite of passage going to prison, where a whole cities, communities can be found in the various state prisons. People go to prison and discover people there who they've missed over the last 5 or 10 years. So we think that this next conference, which will be in July, which is the annual conference that the Black is Back Coalition is mandated to have through its bylaws, will organize itself around this question of electropolitics, and in the process of doing that, try to create a new template for what Black people who are engaged in politics should be doing and how we should carry ourselves. And also, it's not just a template for what we should do, but what it is that we should oppose. If politicians are not addressing these fundamental questions, then they don't deserve our support, and sometimes they require us to work against their elections.
That was Somali Yeshintela, chairman of the Black is Back Coalition, speaking from St. Petersburg, Florida.
American politicians.
Here to pick up the pieces.